Yes. I think the last one was just handed out. I'm sorry about that.
Okay.
I will generate some more for next week.
Okay. Carrie needs a book.
Carrie, I'll see you get to yours before next week. Okay. We are on major point number two, Satan through Job's eyes. In our last class, Brother Jay read the text to us. What we want to do is begin considering some conclusions that we can draw from the things that are said about the adversary in this text. I find it interesting. We see symmetry in the Bible if we look very carefully. I find it interesting that we meet the adversary in the oldest event recorded in scriptures, and we meet him again in the oldest book written in the Bible. If the Bible students are correct about this matter, Job is perhaps the oldest, in terms of the date of writing, books in the Bible. And so it strikes me that the Lord himself is acquainting us with our opponent or our enemy very early on. And that's as it should be. It manifests wisdom. There are some things that are said about Satan or implied about Satan in the first couple of chapters of the book of Job. We will be looking at other texts for support, but most of it will come from Job chapters 1 and 2. One of the things that we learn about the adversary is that he is accountable before God. And that seems evident in Job 1 and 6 and 2 and 1, where he is presenting himself before the Lord. We could spend some time, and I don't think it would be as profitable in this study, we could spend some time talking about how and where and in what manner this presentation took place, but it is less important than the fact that the adversary was presenting himself before the Lord. In Mark, the first chapter and second verse, what we learn is that the minions of the adversary, the evil spirits, are subject to Jesus Christ. So all of these things tell us that he is accountable. However unwilling he may be to submit to the will of God, the fact is that he, like all other beings that exist, are subject to the will of God. Even Jesus Christ himself acknowledged his subjection to the Father multiple times in the book of John. Chapters 5, 6, 8, and 12 make that very evident. And the adversary must render an account, just like all other beings. For his activities, he will render an account. The second thing we know about the adversary is that God knows his mind. Note the question that the divine asks of Satan in the eighth verse of the first chapter. Now, it was read last week. Let's look at it again. It says, "Then the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?'" God was not asking him this for his own information. He was asking this in order to set up circumstances that would result in Job being tested, and a profound example set for us from the days of the ancient times. God's not provoking the adversary here. He already knows what's on Satan's mind. Job's a righteous man. And what's on the adversary's mind when he encounters righteous people? What can I do about this situation? How can I change their condition? It also sends a secondary message to you and I that we're going to find ourselves perhaps more sorely tried and tested by the adversary the closer we draw to God and the more his glory is reflected in our daily lives. We're going to find ourselves tested even more. God already knew that Job was on Satan's mind. The third point is that he is behind every sin committed on earth. At some point, he is behind every sin. The two texts that you see here speaks to his vigilance. Those passages both speak of where he's been and what he's doing when he's giving his account or showing himself to the divine. He says, "I've been busy, so to speak. I've been traveling back and forth through the world. We know this is true about him. Jay, if you would, come to 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. This is a passage from the New Testament that speaks to his unceasing activity. He doesn't take a day off.
Chapter 5, verse
5:8. Yes. Chapter 5, verse 8.
Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour.
Now, in God's creative efforts, we learn that God worked 6 days and rested on the seventh. But I don't read anywhere in the text where the adversary takes a break. He is one who will tempt us 7 days a week. He's one that is resolved to test and try the righteous all the time. He is active 24/7, whenever and wherever we are conscious and aware of what's going on about us, he's involved in the process of temptation at some level. Go ahead.
You allude to the fact that Satan is responsible for every sin on the earth. Now, how does this relate to angels who choose to do wrong?
Well, that would relate to angels in the sense that the sins that they committed, or the leaving their habitation, as it's worded in Peter and Jude's account, that when they did that, they had to be in a realm or a place where temptation was possible. And we know that that's not the nature of heaven. So he would have to be involved, indirectly he would be involved in that he brought about circumstances that led to Adam and Eve's sin in this fallen world. And so any realm where he would have influence would be a realm where they could fall. Okay. I put down here on point number 2, he is the author of most of the suffering in the world. He is not the author of all of the suffering in the world. It is foolish on our part, whether we do so from ignorance or we do so maliciously in attempt to discourage others. It is foolish on our part to say that every hardship that comes to a person is a result of their sin. That's nonsense. It is an indirect result, perhaps, of dwelling in a fallen world, but it may not be and may have nothing to do with their own behaviors and activities. Let's look at some other reasons why, and I put this in here for just this purpose, to help us to understand that while he is behind sin, sin is not behind every form of suffering in this world. Note number 1, letter A. It is the chastening of the Lord. Sometimes hardship comes to us as a result of punishment. Andy, how about turning over to Hebrews chapter 12? Now, I don't want you to read the entire text, but come over to Hebrews chapter 12, and when you get there, let me know that. In this passage, the chastening of the Lord is discussed. Start with 9, just go 9 through 11 will be sufficient.
Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they victory for a few days chasten us after their own pleasures, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness.
Pause for a moment there. Did you catch the last part of that text? Andy read to us that our human fathers give us chastening according to their best judgment, sometimes for their own advantage. But he said the Father in heaven chastens us on occasion when we receive chastening from him for a good reason, for our benefit, for our well-being. He points out that the reason for this is so that we can be partakers in his holiness. The chastening here is actually a form of discipline, perhaps corrective, but it may be instructive, where we are being trained or disciplined for a purpose later on. talk about that more in just a moment. The balance of that text, all the way down through verse 13, the balance of this text tells us to accept this, to receive it, because it's God's purpose that we benefit from it. So sometimes hardship comes our way because of the chastening or the training of the Lord. The second reason is more a preparatory training, not necessarily corrective or instructive, but to prepare someone for a higher, more noble task later on. James chapter 1, verses 2 to 3. James 1, 2 to 3. Chad, please. In James's account, again, you see instruction or training taking place in the context of that passage. I caught you looking at another passage, didn't I? It's all good.
James what?
James chapter 1, okay. Verses 2 and 3, please.
My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience.
There you have it. In fact, we are to happily receive the kind of trials that train us to be more patient, enduring type folks. So there you find hardship or trials coming our way, again, making us better. So the adversary's not behind that. Would he want us to be better? No, most certainly not. I think one of the finest examples of this is that of Abraham. Abraham, especially in chapter 22, finds himself under a test. In fact, the text tells us exactly that is the case, that he is being tested by God. And the test that was offered to Abraham there was that he was to take Isaac and to present him to the Lord as a sacrifice. After the test was over, God makes a declaration regarding Abraham and his suitability as being the one from whom the righteous would come. That's a second reason. Again, nothing to do with the adversary or sin. Yes.
One comment on the previous one about sometimes God chastens us or disciplines us for our good. Well, right up in that context, it says that those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines. And as fathers and as parents, we discipline our children because we love them. We want them to do well. Sometimes when things are going through a hard time for us, or we're going through a trial, and we maybe attribute it to God helping us understand things, understand that it's because he loves us and he's wanting us to do better. And don't think it's just because, why are you doing this? But accepted as God's love for us.
I would agree. And the Hebrew writer also makes the point in that text that we might not see it that way or might have trouble seeing that way. When you were children, and I know it's a long time ago for me, but when we were children and we were about to be disciplined, how many of us, raise your hand, how many of us believed mom and dad when they said, I'm doing this because I love you? It was hard to see it, wasn't it? Now, that's kind of the Hebrew writer's point. It's hard for us to see that the Father loves us when he allows difficulties to come our way for our correction. But it is a fact. And that's what the Hebrew writer wants us to see. Thanks for that point. Okay, the next one is, and you pointed this one out, didn't you, Jay? Time and chance. There you go. Time and chance. Random occurrences that are part of living under the sun. Ecclesiastes 9 and 11, in that passage, look at the text when he talks about the how unfair. You know, we would judge this very unfair. Look at the text where he says, I returned and saw under the sun. Solomon is saying in this series of short sermons, he said, this is my observation. This is my observation. And he's going to give the divine's answer to it. The race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor the bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill. But time and chance happen to them all. Now, that's what Solomon's given to understand, is the explanation in the cases where these unfair things happen. The ones who excel and do well do not always get the reward or the acknowledgement. Solomon says it's part of time and chance. I've said it often, we live in a fallen world. The world fell when Adam and Eve sinned and God cursed the ground for their sake. That's the nature of life under the sun. It isn't going to be perfect. It isn't going to be fair. But that's the way of it. And you cannot blame when someone is a victim of time and chance and suffers hardship because of it. You cannot blame sin in their life. You cannot blame sin in the parents' life or even sin in general unless you want to refer back to the fact that that's what made this a fallen world. Whenever the fellow who was born blind encountered Christ and was healed, what was the discussion regarding the origin of his disability? What were the folks discussing about it?
Whose sin was it?
Was it his or the parents? I thought it was kind of a silly argument, though, because he was born blind. How did his sin generate his blindness? But anyway, that's what they were discussing, which is a testimony to the foolishness of human beings when we speculate as to why someone else is undergoing a trial. When everything is said and done, it's between them and the divine. It's not our judgment to make. It's not ours to make. Okay. But the one answer that Job is going to learn, and he'll study this throughout the writing of this book, in the exchanges between his three counselors and later Elihu the daysman, and finally God's conversation with him. He's going to learn that God is God and Job is not. Infinitely wiser than men. Let's go to these passages, please. Steve, how about coming over to Job chapter 36, verses 22 and 23. Job 36, 22 and 23, please.
Job 26.
36, please.
Behold, God is exalted in his power. Who is a teacher like him? And who has appointed him his wife? And who has said, thou hast done wrong?
Good question, isn't it? Who can say that to the divine? No one can. Who teaches God what is right and wrong? God is righteous, and he is the definition of righteousness. And therefore, whatever the divine chooses is going to be righteous. We may not get it. If we don't get it, it isn't because God is mistaken. It's because we don't understand righteousness, especially the righteousness of the divine in its fullness. We're human beings, and we don't know all things. We don't know all ends and purposes. We cannot know them. The divine is capable not only of knowing all outcomes of the choices that we make in this world, but I would suggest to you that all outcomes of all the possibilities of choices that we could make. God knows all things. And therefore, Job does not know all things. He is arguing with his counselors about whether or not he had sinned. Now, Job has listened to Elihu say this about God, and he dismisses him. So God then comes and speaks to Job and explains it to him. Come with me over to the 42nd chapter. When God is done talking to Job, Job goes like this. I will put my hand over my mouth. I'm not going to say anything more. Job then says about God, and this is the conclusion that he comes to, from all of the things that he had conversed with his counselors, heard from Elihu, and then heard from the divine. I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. That's what Job knows. You asked, he's talking to God, you asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? I uttered what I did not understand. Things do wonderful for me, which I did not know. Why? Because Job is Job. He's not God. Listen, please, let me speak. You said, I will question you and you will answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. And Job says in verse 6 exactly what he should have said in chapter 3, verse 1, when he began recriminating with God over why he was suffering. He says in verse 6 what he should have said in the beginning. Therefore, I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. Now Job has said the right thing. God is God, I am not, and I am sorry for the things that I said. After Job speaks to God, the divine turns to Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, his counselors, and says the following. My wrath is aroused against you and your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. What Job says in verses 2 through 6 is what Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar should have been saying all along. Job, you're suffering, but God is God, and we're not him. Yes?
Now, just to help clear my mind, many times throughout the book of Job, it says, and yet Job did not sin with his mouth.
Up until chapter 3, Job is not... In the first series of speeches, Job really does not begin remonstrating with God until you get through the second series of speeches, at which point Job challenges God. He says, I want an umpire, or a daysman was the term he uses. I want an umpire, someone to put his hand on God and one hand on me and negotiate. That's a challenge. That's a challenge to the divine. It's challenging his authority, rather. Now, I understand that Job is suffering, and sometimes we say things when we're suffering, kind of like you see in the imprecatory Psalms. We say things when we are suffering that express the extremes of human feelings. God's going to judge Job, but Job's acknowledgement that he abhors himself and that he repents in dust and ashes, then God turns to the counselors and said, Job's given me the right answer, suggests that what Job said is actually true. He understood that he had spoken ill against God. Up until the point of chapter 3, verse 1, Job had not sinned, but it was that point he began to question God. Okay. So the point is, sometimes God allows suffering to occur, and we may never receive a satisfying answer in this life. Be content to trust God. We often, when we're attempting to give comfort to someone who is suffering, or especially to someone who has a family member dear to them who's suffered an untimely death, what do we like to do when we offer comfort to them? We also want to give them what we think is an explanation. And that's unhelpful. Because quite often what we're doing is we're making judgments as to why that hardship came their way. Sometimes hardship happens because of sin. Sometimes the chastening of the Lord. Sometimes the training of the Lord. Sometimes the teaching of the Lord in setting an example for others. Sometimes it's just time and chance or random occurrences. And sometimes it's because God is God and we don't know why. The thing we should do when we offer comfort is to point them to the God of all comfort, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, and leave it there. Saw a hand start to go up. Maybe not. Okay. The fourth thing that is implied about the adversary in Job's account is that he's not omniscient. That means he is not all-knowing. He cannot see into the mind of man. The fact that he tries to tempt us, and in many cases unsuccessfully, is testimony that he does not know our minds. He could not see into the mind of Job in the first chapter, verses 9 through 11. He talks about what Job would do if some suffering came his way. This is what Job would do. You've hedged him in. You've protected him. Let some hard times come Job's way and see if he reverences and honors you then. He doesn't know Job the way God knows Job. In the second chapter, same thing. He thought that he knew what Job's mind would be under pressure, just as he thinks he knows what we would do under pressure. He only thinks he knows. Now, he is clever. He's going to exploit our vulnerabilities. But he is not all-knowing. And the one thing that enables us to rebuff him is that God gave us the capacity to choose. We are self-determinant. We decide whether or not we'll yield to the temptation or not. And he can't know what we're going to decide. He can guess, but he cannot know. Fifth thing that is implied about this is that he can do nothing apart from the permissive will of God. What did he have to do in order to bring the loss of Job's income or the loss of Job's health or the loss of Job's children? He had to seek permission. He talks to the divine about this matter. It's not something that he could simply just do without permission. In some cases, you see, the adversary must seek permission to bring hardship. The other case that we see in the New Testament is that of Peter. In Luke, the second chapter, verses 31 and 32, the Lord says to Peter that the adversary has asked for you, as the metaphor he uses, that he may sift you as wheat. He's asked. He wouldn't have to ask if he didn't need to get permission to bring such hardship. Anne, I'm thinking of your hand. No? Okay. Number six. With approval or permission, there's also limitation. God approved the adversary's testing of Job, but there were also limits that he put on him. For example, whenever he wanted to bring hardship against Job's health, what did the Lord say in limitation to him? You can touch his body, but you cannot take his life. Earlier, when he was taking other things away from him, you can take those things, but you cannot touch him. And so you see that there were limitations placed upon him. If there are limitations placed upon him and he must abide by them, what does this say about the power of the divine versus the power of the adversary?
The divine's power is superior. It is superior.
It is superior. And I'll tell you at least two beings who know this, God and the adversary. That's a good lesson for us to learn, that we should know that God has more power than the adversary. Ron?
Yeah, not only does he have more power, Satan's power is less, but it's limited to what God allows him to have that power too.
Right.
So less power, but it's limited by God.
Let's see the limitation, since you raised your hand, come to... You were, in effect, volunteering. Come to 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13. 10 and 13. There are three promises of the divine in this text that impose limitations on temptation.
No temptation is overtaking you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with temptation will also make a way of escape, that you may be able to bear.
All three things, all three promises of the God, of the Father in heaven, are an imposition upon the adversary with regard to temptation. He cannot tempt us beyond our capacity. There was a character by the name of Flip Wilson, and if you're old enough to remember him, you're old enough to remember his caricature of Geraldine. What did Geraldine say when she did something wrong? The devil made me do it. No, the devil didn't make Geraldine or Flip do anything. That was their choice. And it will always be our choice. Yes?
Back to your point about Peter also being that Satan requested to do something special, apparently.
Yes.
To Peter. However, there was a way out of that as well. If you refer back to the garden, Jesus said, pray that you may not fall into
temptation. Exactly. Very good. Well, I'm going to steal some thunder for myself. I better stop right there. Good point. He is limited with regard to us. He has no power upon us beyond what God allows. I want to look at the text in John chapter 19 and verse 11. John 19 and 11 is very telling. Jesus is talking, of course, to Pilate here about Pilate's power, so to speak, over Jesus and his life. And Jesus responds to him, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above." From above implies from whom? Right. You would not be able to do what you're doing if God did not permit it. And if that is the way it is with a man, it is the way it is with the adversary. I like the distinction the Lord makes in the text, if you continue to read, is that the one who has betrayed me has a stricter judgment, in essence, coming against him. Pilate's doing it because it's what circumstances calls on him to do. Judas did it because he wanted to advantage himself. Okay. He cannot possess unwilling, faithful disciples. And that is evident if we consider all of those. Wow, we are running out of time. That is evident if we consider all of those texts. One of the passages, I believe it's the Matthew 12 text, speaks to the matter of the fellow who had the good fortune to have an evil spirit depart from him. Did he replace the evil spirit with good things? No. In fact, he goes so far as to keep himself open or vulnerable, willing and ready to receive the evil spirit back. And the evil spirit brings others like himself. This also implies to us that a person has the power to keep the evil spirit from coming upon him. In Acts 19, you see a text where some itinerant exorcists, self-appointed exorcists, attempt to cast out evil spirits in the name of Jesus who is preached by Paul. And what did the evil spirit say to those sons of Sceva and the itinerant exorcists? What did the spirit say?
Who are you?
Exactly right. Jesus I know, Paul I know, who are you? And that's exactly the case. So what he does, the spirits fall upon them and punish them and drive them from the place. These are fellows who were making themselves vulnerable to that attack by their behavior, by their choices. So it seems to me, it seems to me that one cannot be possessed by the unwilling and faithful, quite often possessed by those who have made themselves open and vulnerable, or who, by nature, were open and vulnerable, for sometimes children were possessed. Satan, this last one, Satan has always been religious. I don't mean religious in the moral sense. I mean religious in the Bible knowledge believing sense. He and his minions are orthodox in their belief. And by that I mean that they understand everything that this book says about the divine. And now, while knowing all of those things, it hasn't advantaged them at all. I love what A.W. Tozer wrote about this. He said, "The devil is a better theologian than any of us, and is a devil still." A side note from that is that you and I might have a great deal of Bible knowledge, and it doesn't benefit us at all. Combined with that must be faith and a willingness to obey. The texts that I have there, of course, are the ones that would be familiar to us from James, the second chapter. In that passage, James says, "You believe in God, that's a good thing, but the devils also believe and tremble." The knowledge, the conviction of God and his power is within them, and they are afraid of it. It just hasn't motivated them to change or do anything that is right about this matter. And the adversary is monotheistic. He knows there is only one God. He just doesn't worship him. He knows, excuse me, that there is one God. Any questions or discussions about this section? These are the kinds of things that you can draw from the book of Job, just the first couple of chapters, and see regarding the that are implied regarding the nature of our adversary. It is fortunate that humankind very early on learned about their opponent in this world.
Paul?
Yes?
Now, speaking of Satan in the sense that I know last week, I believe we spoke about how there almost has to be a wrong in this world. Now, speak in the sense of Satan, I guess the fact is there is no repentance available to Satan. Therefore, he has nothing to gain by accepting his fate. In the sense, God's more powerful than I am, so why not just wreak as much havoc as I can?
That would be a really good discussion to meditate on and hammer out. There is nothing revealed in the scriptures regarding anything in the matter of Satan or the evil spirits with regard to any redemption for them. Nothing revealed. We know, when we talked about the angels, what did we learn about a plan of salvation for the angels? There is none. The text tells us they are reserved in chains of darkness until the judgment. There is no plan of salvation for them. And I think that we can assume, absent anything said directly or by implication in the text, I think we can assume that there is nothing for them as well. Nothing for them. And your point is a good one, that since that is who he is and what he does, and there's no opportunity for him to change, why not go ahead and do that? In terms of being absolute about that, I would be uncomfortable going that far, but that certainly makes sense. Anything else? Good question. Steve?
One other thought that in regard to temptation, that God is not going to allow Satan to tempt us more than what we're able. So that necessarily implies God knows us so closely of the point of temptation that we can endure. And that is comforting to know that God is so attuned to our growth, our spiritual position, and he knows us so deeply and so well, he holds Satan back and says, I will not allow you to be tempted more than what you are able. And as we see this happen with Job, we see this happens with us too. And that has to give us assurance that we don't have to. And we can look for that way of escape.
I would say that the knowledge that God is shielding us from being tempted beyond what we're capable should serve to us almost, I don't want to use the term too loosely, but almost as an amulet, a comforting thought that will protect us when we are under temptation. God's not going to let this get beyond my strength. I think of the three promises, though, that are delivered in that text. The first one should be the one that indicts us the most. There is no temptation come our way except such as is common to man. It means it's something that human beings have or can experience successfully, deal with successfully. What we like to say when we are under temptation or fallen into sin is that my circumstances are special. My conditions are unique. And because my situation is special and unique, God will understand. No. There is no special set of circumstances or unique conditions to our temptations that are outside the norm of what human beings have faced and successfully overcome. Those three promises are exceptional. Let's begin with common devices of Satan. I believe we should be able to complete that as well as introduce part two. Lucifer and fallen angels, is their sin in heaven? That's one I know a number of you said, we can't wait till you get there. That's where we'll begin with our next class.